Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 124 of Wheat All About It, or what I've entitled, A Visit to LOMO. The Apollo 11 of Snake River Dams continues. For those who didn't listen to the first part, the name of this episode comes from the fact that Lower Monumental opened for business in 1969, the same year Neil Armstrong took his historic steps on the moon. Perhaps every job has its perks, but for my money, being a reporter has some of the best, because reporters get to do interesting things and then write about them. Back in my days working for the Capital Press, I got the idea to ask a barge company about riding a towboat down the Lower Snake River from Lewiston, Idaho to Vancouver, Washington. I was frankly surprised how quickly Tidewater approved my request, but this was pre-9/11, when a lot of things were easier. I remember a few things from that trip. One was climbing to the wheelhouse about 45 feet above the deck. Another was the constant noise and vibration of the combined 4,000 horsepower diesel engines pushing 14,000 tons of wheat. But what I remember best about the journey along the Snake Columbia River system were the locks as the towboat and its barges descended from an elevation of 745 feet in Lewiston to sea level in Vancouver. Admittedly, even locks become a bit ho-hum by the time you've reached Bonneville, which is the last of the 8 locks our tow went through, but I certainly remember the Lower Granite Lock, the first lock outside of Lewiston. Getting into a lock with such a huge tow is tricky. Captains talk about the barges acting as sails because of the way the wind pushes against them, and then there are river currents too. High above the deck in their captain's chairs, towboat captains command their huge floating football fields using both hands, adjusting engine input and direction based on communication with the deckhand who is on the furthest barge out front. Locks are big. The lock at Lower Monumental is 675 feet long, or about the length of 2 football fields, by 86 feet wide. I once thought the locks were filled and emptied by large pumps. In fact, they are filled and emptied by the power of the river and gravity. Upstream, under the surface of the river, are 2 tainter valves that open to direct a torrent of water along a conduit toward the locking mechanism. Let's speak for a moment of tainter valves. You've probably seen them on the front of dams along the river, even if you don't know what they're called. They were invented by Jeremiah Tainter in 1886. One end of the valve is fixed with hinges, the other moves up and down to open or close using a hydraulic cylinder. Once you appreciate what they do, you may never forget their simplicity or the name of their inventor. On an upriver lockage, the raw power of the river flows into the lock where it is tamed by what looks like a series of windows or portals at different levels all around the rectangular concrete lock. This allows the water to flow in quickly but gently. A lock that would take 6.5 years to fill with a garden hose takes 28 minutes when the river is your hose. The lock is emptied by gravity, water flowing out via a conduit and the drain valves that are located 40 feet under the water below the dam. On a downriver voyage, after slipping the tow into the lock and tying up alongside a buoy that's attached to a slot that descends or rises with the tow, the upriver lock door closes. Then the tainter valve at the end of the conduit in the river below twists open, pouring the lock water back into the river. In 27 minutes, the towboat and the tow have descended almost 100 feet, which makes it one of the highest single-lift locks in the world. When the downstream gate opens, there is still 15 feet of water left in the lock. The captain engages the engine and moves the tow back into the tailwater of the river channel. While the dams on the Lower Snake generate plentiful, inexpensive electricity and also have a flood control capability, it is the capacity of the river system to serve as inland waterways that wheat farmers appreciate most, and not just farmers whose location justifies their going to the river. Farmers whose wheat will never touch a barge also benefit from the lower rates BNSF railroad charges in the region, owing to the region's 2 transportation alternatives, something so-called captive shippers don't have. As the 3-week outage progressed, logs and other debris had floated in front of the upstream lock door. The debris loads vary each year depending on the activity that has occurred upriver, especially if there have been fires. I'm always asking questions, and sometimes I'll admit they're stupid. But even stupid questions can elicit smart responses. Jeanette Wilson, who retired as a major from the U.S. Army and who has served in various positions with the Corps' Walla Walla District since then, most recently as the woman in charge of LOMO, laughed as she answered. The logs that are over here, do you have to crane those out before you open everything up?
Where's the towboat companies? No, so this is, we're starting to enter spring freshet, and we start to get, this is normal. This is the time of year we start to see the debris loads coming through. We get some very large logs that come through, depending on the fire season. It depends on what is there and if it's going to impact the safety of the vessel. And so if we can flush, we'll flush it out of the way. If it's just a couple, and the tug captain and our operators will talk back and forth, and we'll make a decision together sometimes. That's not uncommon. There are other times that we get these massive mats when we get further along in the year where we have to do some creative flushing to get it out of the way. So it's different every single year. So what you see here right now, next year there might not be anything, and the year after it could be all the way back beyond the guide wall. In fact, it was like, what, 2 years ago? It was the year before last that it was really, really bad, and it took a lot of work. And these logs can jam up gates sometimes, so the guys are having to come out in the middle of the night to get the lock back in operation.
She had another opportunity to set the record straight as she explained the fish system at Lower Monumental, as well as the other four Snake River dams.
This ladder is not for the juveniles going downstream. This is for the adults going upstream. The big thing is adults are looking for velocity, so there is a lot of science going into how this is operated. We also have some fish pumps that create fish attraction water. We have a ladder on the other side with another. It's really weird. On the downstream, it's called the fish entrance. And the upstream on the other side is called the fish exit. Counterintuitive. But we have fish pumps that are down on our north side to help attract. That's where they tend to prefer to be. And so it's really big deal. We monitor it daily, weekly. We have screens on our units. You can see them sticking up right now. You see those rusty brown looking things sticking out on the deck over there? Yes, probably because we're doing maintenance on them. Those are our fish screens, STSs. And so these traveling screens are down in front of our units during fish passage. They're to help direct the juvenile instead of going through the unit, they'll go through a channel that comes out. All see the concrete flume across the river that goes down to that facility? That's the JFF. And so we're guiding the fish to either go through the JFF.
JFF means?
Or a juvenile fish facility. Mm-hmm. And you see a discharge pipe further down, so they're either going to be barged. You see the boat down there working? He's working on our barge loading dock. So the fish could be loaded on a barge, a truck, or discharged out of a pipe to continue down the river. Those are the juveniles. The adults are working their way up the ladder. And so we have an entire staff for the juvenile fish facility that takes care of us biologically for the entire facility.
Are there fish coming up and down at this point?
There are. We're actually, it's the beginning of the season, but we went in service a month early this year. So typically we don't start juvenile fish passage until 1 April. But this year we started 1 March.
Wilson led us into the bowels of the dam through stairs in a tunnel with the admonition that there are many such tunnels. Needless to say, none of us went wandering.
I just wanted to show you, like, when you're inside the dam, having the awareness of where you are. Because that does not go where we want to go. And so it's very easy to get turned around in a facility. So just having the wherewithal and the guys not only having to learn... I'm out of breath on Sarah, sorry. But the navigation lock system and how big it is and how this is all connected. And if you think about it, the entire dam has galleries like this all throughout that the guys are maintaining. It's just amazing what they do here. Like, I have the best job ever.
Kenny Koberlein, the navigation business line manager, who I introduced in the first part of the podcast, led us into a small room with two giant spools overlaid with cable. Part of the locking door mechanism, Koberlein pointed to the small gear near the bottom and then proceeded to tell us why Ice Harbor Lock, the next dam downstream, had to be closed during extremely poor weather in late February. You'll hear him mention skewing. That's when a vertical lift gate doesn't lift equally on both sides.
You might be familiar with the outage, the short outages that were going on at Ice Harbor right before in February. Well, the problem was is that with the snow and the weather, they got about 30 tons of ice on the gate. And there's at that 720-ton gate at Ice Harbor, the downstream gate, is lifted and turned by a 20-horsepower motor. And so that ice, they had to increase the counterweight, so crew had to man-pack the weights to increase the tonnage on the counterweight to counteract the ice, and all that took time. And there was some skewing, and frankly, there were some software problems with some of the VFDs that drive the motor. But at any rate, the point I'm trying to make is that when an outage happens, you know, Jeanette is the person that's driving the crews to get the lock back up. So, and there's a lot of times where the crews have to do a whole lot of things to get it right, you know, and engineers like Levi are brought in to try and diagnose the problem, you know, what's really causing it, what's the solution, can we do this to get us by, you know, we were trying to get to this outage, so that was, so that's why ice was up and down, and then I know there was a lot of frustration about it, but you need to know that there's a big crew that our mission is to keep the lock open.
You heard Koberlein mention Levi. That's Levi Van Stedham, who you heard from in the first part of our tour. He troubleshoots electrical problems within the Walla Walla district. One of his jobs is retrofitting the electrical units that power the lock infrastructure at LOMO. He brought us into one of the substations to explain how his crew is replacing 50-year-old electrical breakers and other equipment. You will hear the hum of electrical interference in the fully charged room until we step outside again.
The challenge with this that we are really trying to focus on as far as the engineering design portion of it is we have to replace all of this, but we don't have any more room. If you look on the other side, it's this length, this width. And so we're strategically replacing one piece at a time, putting in new equipment, hooking up the old equipment, and then rinsing and repeating until we get to a point where we can't do that anymore, and then that's when we're looking at relying on those 2 to 3 week normal outage. But this is just kind of the constraints, you know, that we're looking at, and the equipment. I mean, this again, these breakers, and I mean, they're safe, and we've had to replace them in the past, but again, it requires us to modify current breakers to be able to fit in the old cabinets and be able to contain operation. So this substation room is what powers the other substation room, and so again, the design that we're looking at is providing dual feeds and emergency tie between the two, so that way, again, increased reliability. One of the other aspects is, since we expect this stuff, the new stuff, to last 50 years, we're actually providing environmental controls for this space to dehumidify and maintain the better, a little bit better condition, and then also elevating these, because as you can see from the ceiling on some of these areas, concrete is not impervious to water, so water does kind of come through in some of these areas, and so we're, again, trying to strategically make design decisions that will make the equipment, elevate the equipment off the ground in case there is water intrusion.
And how old is this equipment here?
This was in 1969, so it's in typical service life for this kind of equipment is 25 to 30 years, and that's under ideal conditions, which we're... Right outside, there's a vent that sits right over there next to the spillway and the fish ladder, and that lets in all humidity, and that makes it not ideal. But we do what we can. So everything that I was just referencing for electrical here, we are also experiencing up and down the river, right? So we also have a sister project at McNary that's doing the exact same thing. They're doing their full power and controls upgrade for their nav lock, and it's, again, trying to address the same situation. They're 50-year-old pieces of equipment. You know, increasing the reliability and maintainability. The other part is trying to find replacement parts for these, right? So I know you guys have to custom fab breakers because they don't make them like this, obviously, anymore. So it goes back to your, you know, the part being able to get parts readily available. Those aren't even an hour away. Those are custom fab pieces that, you know, that can potentially impact. But you guys have spares and everything, so.
At this point, we came back up to the surface through another set of stairs to stand alongside the massive concrete lock. When it's full, and it wasn't during maintenance, it will hold the equivalent of 66 Olympic-sized swimming pools of water. As I said earlier, the locks still have 15 feet of water in them when the downstream lock gate opens and a barge powers out. It may take 27 minutes to get most of the water out, but that last 15 feet is more complicated, as Don Redman, the chief of maintenance at the dam, explains.
So it takes us about 3 days to actually unwater the lock. So in it of itself is a large job.
Now, it takes 28 minutes to get a barge through. Why does it take 3 days?
Well, we have to place bulkheads, which are basically big metal plates to not allow the water to come where we want it out of, to isolate it. So that's the only way we could actually unwater it. We have a floating bulkhead downstream that I'll show everybody. So there's quite a bit of coordination to actually unwater these.
So when you're actually putting a barge through and you're going down the river and so you're taking the water out, there's still a lot of water in it at the end. Is that correct?
Correct. The draft is, I think it's 15, yep, at least 15 feet of draft. So we come to the tailwater level that the barges can move in and out.
As our group looked over the lip of the low wall surrounding the lock, Redman described the process for filling it. An engineering feat in itself.
Upstream on either side of the lock are the fill valves, and these are the large tainer valves. So we open those up, the water comes through the conduit, which we can't see, it's underneath, but they're basically the conduits of water. They flow into these laterals. These laterals are hollow, and then there are, it's a little hard to see, but there's small windows. And the water comes out of the windows, so these are basically large diffusers. And that's how we dissipate the energy. If you can imagine this much energy up top rushing in. And if you watch the lock being filled, it's kind of just this gentle raising of the water.
And so how does one get a job like this?
You know, I was pretty fortunate. I actually came to the Corps as an environmental engineer from pulp and paper. And started working out at Little Goose and then worked my way into different jobs, district environmental compliance, and now this chief of maintenance.
Uh-huh.
So, but we take all kinds, you know, there's mechanics, electricians, maintenance, admin, non-engineers such as myself, engineers.
So. It must have been easier to be the maintenance guy when it was brand new.
I would say so. These are aging dams that need quite a bit of work.
Just as many civilians would be lost by the language of farmers, the language of those who work on the dams is also specialized. As much as I love podcasts, seeing things has its advantages. Here, Redman describes the bulwark, which keeps water out of the lock during maintenance.
The valve itself, we call the skin plate, and then back the arms where it comes in together on the concrete, those are our trunnion bearings. So this is holding back the water. Our tainer valves are actually reversed. Waters would be going the other way, so they're in tension. And so we have seals around them, and that basically is how we seal it off, and we have to change those seals every so often. It's a big job. Those seals are heavy. There's lots of bolts. It takes about a day to replace a seal. Inspect the trunnion bearings, replace grease lines. And in our case, and I'll talk about it, we're repairing some of the cracks in the tainer valves. So we're doing quite a bit of welding right now. You can see one of our mechanics over there. So he's scraping off some of the old grease, and we're applying a new grease to the wire ropes. So we have to take really good care of our equipment. It's in a fairly harsh environment. And again, we are using a EAL lubricant on the wire ropes.
EAL, what's that?
Environmentally acceptable lubricant. It is non-toxic, it biodegrades in 28 days, and it does not bioaccumulate.
So do you have to do this every 28 days?
You know, if it's not submerged in water all the time, it actually stays on like a normal lubricant. We cannot use it on equipment that is submerged.
And when were these cables last replaced?
This came with the new gate, so in 2011.
At one point along the lock, there was a color-coded schedule of the lock outage with the timing for each day's work and when it was expected to be accomplished. Everything was going well until cracks were found in the conduit that drains water from the lock, as Redmond explains.
Up until we found the cracks, we were actually ahead of schedule, which was good because it gave us some time to react and put a plan in place and ensure that we get this lock back in service.
And so what are you repairing it with, epoxy or something?
No, the cracks we identified, we had somebody ultrasonic testing UTM where the crack tips were, and then we stopped drilling. So we drill those crack tips out so that it does not crack anymore. Two of them identified where we had to weld plates over the cracks. And so that is what we're in the process of doing right now.
Heather Stebbings, Government Relations Director for the Pacific Northwest Waterways Association, has been to her share of dams. And yet, here she was again at Lower Monumental. I asked her why it was important that she be present for another dam show and tell.
I think it always helps to see the scale of the projects you're working on, and there are so many different components. So every year we're advocating for different pieces of the lock, whether it's the tainter valves or, you know, just general repairs or concrete repairs. So it's good to actually be able to be on the ground and see what you're talking about. It helps tell the story a bit better.
Okay, Tom, what about you? Why are you here?
Tom would be Tom Kammerzell from Colfax, where he raises Highland beef cattle and serves on the board of the Port of Whitman County. I've known Kammerzell for more than 20 years, and I've been impressed by his growth as an advocate for agriculture and especially for the Lower Snake River dams.
As the chair of the Inland Ports and Navigations Group, which is the group that has intervener status from Astoria to Lewiston, I want to familiarize myself with each one of the dams that I'm representing. And seeing each and every one of them, and each and every one of them is different and unique, is very important to me.
How many have you been to now?
Five of them. I've been to all the ones on the Snake, plus the dam, the Dalles, during these outages and opportunities to see them.
And what have you come away with?
How important this system is for navigation, for the economy of the Northwest and the nation. It really is. It's a water freeway. The other thing that most people don't understand is how environmentally friendly they are, because when you talk about moving commodities, moving them on the river system is as ecologically friendly as it gets, way friendlier than rail, and extremely friendlier than moving everything on the roads. And our road systems don't have the capacity, they don't have the money, states don't have the money to maintain them. And for safety, you have on the Snake River system, if you were to get rid of these, that would add 136,000 trucks per year. And in the I-5 corridor from Portland up to Tacoma, there's not capacity for much more load, and semis and passenger cars and bicycles do not play nice together.
Wilson ended our tour with a thank you, not just to the folks who came on March 19th, I think, but also for the men and women who work at the dam and lock every day.
And then lastly, thank you everyone for coming out. We say that a lot because we are so remote, and so this big of a group is a really big treat because we love to talk about what our guys do. I mean, they really, really work hard out here, and it's really a lot of fun to be able to share what they do to keep this place in service and to keep it reliable. So really appreciate you making the trip out today. When you head out, some of us will stay up top to answer questions for those of you who maybe have a couple extra. Please drop off your blue hard hats, though. I need to collect those. No souvenirs today, sorry.
As I was saying at the top of the episode, being a reporter has its perks, but so does being Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission. Not everybody gets to go on a tour of the Lower Monumental Lock and Dam. I hope you enjoyed the tour of LOMO. It is a monument in and of itself to the structures man can build. but construction may be the easier part of the effort. Maintaining the dam for the last 50 years so it can continue to contribute to the region for another 50 is a more difficult proposition, as you heard. If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider it my gift to you. And now, please pass the gift along. That's right, build the audience. Then join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.